This hour gives us our greatest opportunity yet to understand the process of trying to get fossil fuels out of the ground using the process called hydraulic fracturing, fracking in the common usage now. Our guest tells the story of a woman who once worked with the gas and oil industry until fracking fouled her well water at her Alberta home. But the book Slick Water also takes a long and broad look at the history and workings of fracking. Author Andrew Nikiforuk is a Canadian journalist who writes about energy, economics, and the West, with many articles in some of Canada's top publications. He's won 7 National Magazine Awards and an award for investigative journalism. His 2009 book on Canada's tar sands won the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award. Andrew Nikiforuk, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So what drew you to coverage of the energy industry and its many issues?
Well, I've lived in Alberta for nearly 25 years, and living in Alberta is a bit like living in Texas or living in Wyoming or Colorado or Louisiana. I mean, they're all oil jurisdictions where governments get really hooked and dependent on the revenue stream from oil and gas drilling. And so I've been writing about the industry for that length of time. And what struck me, I guess, about Jessica Earn's story, I guess, is that, here was a member of the oil patch, somebody who had worked for some of the most powerful companies in the patch, companies like Chevron and companies like Murphy Oil, the great Canadian oil sands company, and, of course, in Canada, which was one of the largest natural gas producers in North America at one time. After spending all of that time working for industry, found that she has now spent really the remainder of her life fighting against the industry. And, you know, that's quite a story.
So Jessica Earn's own story on the main events of Slick Water do take place in Alberta, but the first incident you relate is a gas explosion in Los Angeles in 1985. Why is that story in here?
Well, because that's really the first story about hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling that indicates there will be problems, and big problems. And Los Angeles kind of illustrates them all. It is one of North America's oldest oil and gas basins. The place has been thoroughly drilled in the 1900s, 1920s, 1930s.
I should let people know, if they want to Google Los Angeles and oil derricks for images, you'll see amazing pictures of an L.A. in the 30s and 40s. It looks like a Christmas tree farm, the Christmas trees being the oil derricks.
I mean, yeah, you could almost swing from derrick to derrick.
Yeah.
Some of them were planted so closely together. I tell you, there was this intensive drilling taking place. Southern California, that in those days, was the Kuwait of the United States, and it helped launch the car culture in North America, and largely because of the huge amount of oil that was being found there. But then these wells started to dry up and deplete, and industry and the cities started to grow up and grew up in many of these abandoned oil fields where wells were poorly plugged and sort of left behind, and buildings were built on top of entire fields. And then that brings us up to 1985. Well, at that point, industry had started to reenter a lot of these older wells in the 1960s and 1970s, and they were using horizontal drilling. And they were injecting either natural gas or water into these wells to help produce more oil. In 1985, a bunch of methane migrated from one of these operations into the basement of the Dress for Less store. There was a massive explosion. Nearly 24 people were injured, some of them badly burned. And it took the fire department days upon days to put out the methane flames that were coming up through the cracks in the sidewalk around the building. And in fact, the city closed down the Fairfax district for a week or two. While an intensive investigation went forward, the investigation wasn't really all that intense in the end, and omitted the prime culprit, which would be gas migrating from leaking oil and gas installations in the area. And instead, the commission established to find a cause, blamed it all on swamp gas, and said, well, you know, just swamp gas. And
that seems like a common blame target, is swamp gas, because nobody's responsible for swamp gas.
That's right. You know, and it's kind of like blame it on nature, which has been a very standard industrial approach when you come up with big industrial problems. And that acid rain back in the 1970s and 80s, I mean, the industry said, well, that's all natural, was industry's response to the initial science on that. And so then it took a couple of other scientists to piece together this story. Scientists very familiar with the oil and gas industry, and Richard Meehan and Douglas Hamilton, and they said, well, wait a moment, this is, you know, this gas has come from oil and gas activity in the area. There are more than 500 wells, many of them abandoned in the area. Some of them are leaking, and the horizontal drilling combined with the practice of water flooding or natural gas flooding into these old reserves created fractures, and these fractures released gas to the surface that found its way into the basement of the Dress for Less store. And so what's remarkable about the story is that Jessica Ernst, when she read it, realized that, wow, this is exactly what more or less happened in Rosebud, Alberta.
All right, we'll pick up the story from Slick Water on the other side of a break. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the award-winning Canadian environmental journalist Andrew Nikiforuk. He's the author of the book Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry, the insider being Jessica Ernst in Alberta and the many, many problems she went through trying to stop what was happening to her own property because of fracking around her. Andrew tells that story in a larger context along with the history and operations of fracking. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the Ross Dress for Less explosion in Los Angeles in 1985 was ultimately ascribed to poorly tended wells and methane seepage out of those. And this is essentially what Jessica Ernst found happening on her own property?
Yeah, and in fact, it's not just Jessica Ernst, it's what people have found right across North America. But one of the greatest liabilities associated with fracking is that you have, you know, I think 4.5 million wells have been now drilled in North America since the 1850s and 1860s. Almost all of these wells are leaking methane. And when you take hydraulic fracturing, which is a technology that is really all about brute force, you are rattling and shaking all of that existing plumbing and causing gas to migrate to the surface or to migrate into aquifers. And what happened in Rosebud was that not only did industry do that, there was an existing oil and gas field there, which they rattled mightily. But in Jessica Ernst's case, they also fracked directly into an aquifer. And in the process, were producing nothing but water, they had to shut down this particular well, with the result that they actually forced the methane to travel through the groundwater into other people's water wells. And Jessica Ernst had so much methane in her water well that she could literally light it on fire. There were explosive amounts, so we're talking about anywhere between 30 and 60 milligrams per liter, which is huge. You know, in comparison, most water wells contaminated in the United States are on the order of somewhere between, you know, 5 and 15 milligrams per liter.
You know, Andrew, that particular point about the being able to light your water on fire, I brought that up to a representative of the gas industry because southwestern Oregon could be home to the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export terminal and a 230-mile pipeline to get to it. And the pipeline company rep said, well, you know, the thing about the movie Gasland is those people could light their water on fire before anybody ever started fracking around them.
That's industry standard line. And Jessica Ernst was told that too. They said, oh, Jess, your water was always contaminated. And she said, nuts to that. I mean, she is a scientist. She's a trained biologist who'd worked in the patch. And so she started doing her research. And first of all, I mean, her water well had been regularly tested. Her well had also been properly maintained and chlorinated on a regular basis. And the water testing all said, you know, there's a line on the form itself that says gas present, yes or no. And it had always said no. There was no gas present in her water. So So she looked around in the greater area in Rosebud to find out, okay, well, is there, has gas been migrating into water wells from old coal mines or something else? And she found, again, very, very few cases of where, I mean, I think it was less than 0.5% where there might be some gas in the water. So it's not a natural occurrence. But this all changes once you've rattled a formation with hydraulic fracturing. So she found a case, and even in Alberta, in the Lloydminster fields, it's a heavy oil field, where there was little gas contamination of water prior to the drilling of this field. But afterwards, and there was an enormous amount of horizontal drilling going on afterwards, the amount of gas contamination of water increased dramatically. And in fact, this is what the science shows, is that once you create all of these pathways in the earth with all of these oil and gas wells, and then you frack them, we see much more gas migration. And that's the truth of the matter.
Rattling is a good descriptive term. So there are a couple of principles to latch onto here. Is the frack process essentially the same for gas or for oil, or basically anything you're pulling out of the ground?
The frack process is basically the same. It all changes. The recipe for each and every frack can be quite different depending on the formation the industry is trying to crack open. You know, in Alberta, along the Rocky Mountains, we use an awful lot of petroleum distillate and diesel fuel and hydrocarbons to frack rock. in other places, such as Texas, I mean, you use a lot of slick water, and slick water might be 5 million gallons or 10 million gallons of water mixed with some gels and some petroleum distillate to help that water travel faster down the wellbore to bring more force to the rock in order to crack it open.
How much force is sent into the ground to frack? I mean, we talk about the tremendous brute force here, and obviously if it's strong enough to crack open or at least make larger existing cracks in rock, this is a fair amount of pressure.
This is a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean, at some well sites now, they've assembled up to 60,000 horsepower to propel this stuff into the ground. And so much force is now being used. I mean, the industry is causing earthquakes all over North America. You're propelling these fluids at very high speeds into the ground, 1 to 2 miles into the ground, in some cases in much more shallower. And of course, that's where all the natural faults are in the earth. And industry is finding that it is connecting on a regular basis to many of these faults. Causing significant earthquake activity in places like Ohio, Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, British Columbia, and Alberta. And in Alberta, we've had earthquakes as high as 4.8 magnitude. Once you get to 5, you're into all kinds of public safety issues in terms of damage to infrastructure and homes.
Andrew Nikiforuk, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. You mentioned that Jessica Ernst did once work in the oil patch, worked with the petroleum business. What did she do in her capacity as biologist?
Well, she was doing wildlife impact studies. She was also doing pipeline easements. She was doing consultation with First Nations when companies wanted to come onto their land and drill there. And she had a very successful environmental service company business. But since 2011, she has not had one contract from the oil and gas business.
Is that when she filed her lawsuit?
Actually, she filed her lawsuit just before then. Her lawsuit has been now active for 7 years, and she sued the Alberta government. She sued Encana Corporation, and she sued the Alberta regulator, which would be, if you lived in Texas, it would be like suing ExxonMobil, the government of Texas, and the Railroad Commission all at once.
Okay, so she's really taking on the big folks, and are they just stringing her along with motions and all the things that usually delay things in court?
That's exactly what they're doing. Both government and industry have a lot of resources and access to lawyers, and so they've been fighting this remarkable legal standoff in the courts. And so far, she has not even had an opportunity to present any evidence. And in most of these cases, what happens is that the landowners settle. So the industry contaminates your well water or, you know, abuses your land in some other way. And they come forward and they offer you a check. And it's usually not a big check, but it's $50,000, $60,000. And then they say, all right, sorry about your water, but will you sign this confidentiality agreement? And then they go on and then they do the whole process all over again to somebody else. The regulators, the oil and gas regulators, kind of like this approach to covering up the problem because they don't have any problem to regulate. The legal mechanism that is being used here, though, is the same that the Catholic Church used to cover up the abuse of pedophile priests in places like Boston and Minneapolis in the 1980s. You know, a child would be abused by a pedophile priest. The bishop would send a lawyer to the family. Money would be exchanged. You know, a confidentiality agreement would be signed. The priest would be assigned to another parish, and the cycle of abuse would go on. And what makes Jessica Ernst's case unique here is that she's not prepared to be part of that cycle. And she wants all the evidence put on the table. And that's what makes her case so formidable, because it will really expose a lot about the industry and its incredible liabilities and how poorly regulators have dealt with these liabilities.
So she just nixes that out of hand. She will not go for a settlement.
No, she will not. No, and she made that decision a long time ago. She watched other people settle, and she has great sympathy for people who have settled because many of them have been grievously harmed. Their children are sick. They've lost their livestock. And having to truck in your water on a regular basis is an onerous thing. And she does it every week. Every week she goes and picks up water and delivers it back to her place in Rosebud.
So in talking about settlements in lawsuit cases, the victims of the Ross Dress for Less blast that you mentioned in the book in Los Angeles in 1985 did sue. Who'd they sue and what did they do?
They settled out of court. So that there's no record again of what really happened there and why. And that's unfortunate because the lawyer representing the people who were injured assembled a crack scientific team that put together all of the evidence. And it would have been, stuff on the public record that really would have flagged hydraulic fracturing as a problem for the industry in terms of gas migration, groundwater contamination, and the rattling of old oil and gas infrastructure in the ground. All of that stuff would have been flagged, and we would have known about it. But in this case, they settled for a good sum. Industry was quite happy at this point to put the matter behind them, and then you have this wonderful kind of silence that follows the whole thing, and no real public record of what happened.
The Canadian journalist Andrew Nikiforuk, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, he's the author of a new book called Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry, that one person being Jessica Ernst in Alberta. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone by email jx@jeffnet.org. One of the major strengths of this book is the detailed history of fracking, and it is not a recent concept. So take us back to 19th century Pennsylvania, if you would, Andrew.
Okay, well, Jeff, I mean, the history is absolutely fascinating. I was blown away by this. But fracking really started or was the invention of a cashiered Union colonel from the Civil War, a man by the name of Colonel Roberts. And he came up with the idea of dropping torpedoes into aging oil wells in Pennsylvania. And so, the biggest oil boom in the United States started there in the 1860s. And it was a mad rush to Pennsylvania, and it was, something much bigger even than the California Gold Rush. And, of course, these wells depleted very quickly, and the solution was to send down a torpedo and to crack open rocks and fracture them and to get the well going again. Didn't always work, but soon everyone was torpedoing their exhausted wells up there. And Colonel Roberts was a very litigious guy, and he would sue anyone who used his patented torpedo or similar mechanism. And with the result that there was this black market industry in fracking started. And these guys would strap nitroglycerin to their backs, and they'd go out into the woods and be hired by independent oil and gas drillers, and would blow their wells in the middle of the night, and they became known as moonlighters. And they did this to escape the Pinkertons hired by Colonel Roberts. And then fracking sort of evolved from there, and it's always been an evolution into more and more brute force. And so industries tried a variety of very corrosive acids to etch into the rock and frack it open. Then they graduated to fluids of one kind or another, such as diesel fuel, napalm, water, and river sand. And the river sand would be injected down into the wellbore to help keep the cracks open so that the oil and gas would continue to flow from the fractured formation. Then there was thought of, why don't we try a nuclear bomb? And that was Project Gas Buggy in Colorado. And engineers thought it would be the mother of all fracks. And unfortunately, they discovered at the end of the day that there was no market for radioactive natural gas.
And was it actually tried? Did they actually use nuclear devices?
They actually did it. Wow. Not once, but twice. And it was part of Project Plowshare. So it was the whole idea of trying to find a peaceful use for atomic bombs. And they did the same thing in the Soviet Union and with massive groundwater contamination problems as a consequence. And then, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, fracking just got bigger. They started to call them mega fracks, where they were using more and more fluids of one kind or another. Whether it was nitrogen or sometimes CO2 or natural gas or enormous amounts of water, to the point that in the late 1970s, the fracking was starting to cause earthquakes in rural Oklahoma. They knew even then that injecting fluids at very high speeds over short periods of time into the earth's crust that you could cause earthquakes. And then we come right up to the modern day where, we're talking the average frack is anywhere between 5 to 10 million gallons of water. And with using 20,000 horsepower or 30,000 horsepower to inject this stuff at high speeds into the ground. And
30,000 horsepower.
Industry could even describe it quite pithily as a combination of brute force and ignorance, and that's a Schlumberger executive describing his very own technology. Good description for it.
Just to give an idea, the amount of horsepower you're talking about, the 30,000 horsepower is the equivalent of about eight of today's modern railroad locomotives. The strongest ones. So that's a lot of horsepower. We have an email here.
When you add up all of the horsepower the industry used, it adds up to the power generated by 11 nuclear reactors, and that's what the United States is using on a daily basis to crack open these very extreme and difficult shale formations.
So a great deal of energy expended to get energy out of the
yep.
ground. Bruce in Ashland writes, when we introduce a slippery fluid or release slippery fluids in the earth, it leads to fault slippage, not only polluting our groundwater, but fracturing deposits of chemicals that then release for thousands of years. In my mind, drilling and fracturing and contamination from the top 5 miles of the planet possess the biggest threat to our atmosphere and life support systems. Over time, we may be reducing the possibility of our survival on Earth. Reminds me of the myth of Atlantis, misuse of technology. So says Bruce in Ashland. From your research, what's generally in frack fluids today?
Well, there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, there are up to, 1,000 different chemicals being used, and they range from pretty benign stuff that you might find in your kitchen to highly toxic stuff, such as diesel fuel and petroleum distillate.
And it's not just the fluid. There are propants in there, too?
And propants. And the propants can range everything from ceramics to nails to you name it. They've sent it down there to very different, very fine forms of silica, glass.
To prop the cracks open?
To prop the cracks open. And you need different properties at different depths because it gets pretty hot down on the earth, too.
Wow. And so where does the term slick water come from?
Well, it comes from the industry itself, and that was the term they used to describe what really, it was George Mitchell in South Texas, and his company came up with the idea of slick water fracs, and because they tried everything to crack open the Barnett Shale, and nothing really seemed to work until they arrived at these very large volumes of water, slickened with chemicals, so that they would travel down the wellbore much faster.
Well, much more to talk about with Andrew Nikiforuk. His book is called Slick Water, Fracking and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Back with Andrew and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Canadian journalist Andrew Nikiforuk. He writes a lot about the gas and oil industries and economics in Western Canada. His latest book is called Slick Water, Fracking and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. The insider being Jessica Ernst, the biologist who used to work with the oil and gas industry, and they ran afoul of her when they began fracking around her property and ruined her water. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about her case and fracking much more broadly. 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I don't want to run completely past Jessica in favor of talking about the history of fracking. A couple of things make her a really particularly tough character, and you get into this in her book. She had a pretty rough childhood from the sounds of it.
She did, yeah. She was horribly sexually abused, not once, but several times, and as a child. And all of these experiences came back to haunt her in her 30s. And she spent a good 10 years in therapy dealing with all of these issues. And her psychologist at the time told her, you know, Jess, these awful things that happened to you as a child, you know, they will make you a stronger person in the end. And at first, Jess thought this was just a terrible notion, a terrible thing to say, and she rejected it out of hand. But now she appreciates actually what her psychologist was trying to tell her, because it gives her a rather remarkable courage. I mean, the worst that could ever be done to a human being has been done to Jessica Ernst, and she has now dealt with that and moved on. And and she feels that this issue is so important because it really, it's all about cracking this cycle of abuse. And she finds it unconscionable that there are actually legal mechanisms to hide groundwater contamination and abuse of citizens by corporations so that regulators don't have to do their jobs. She has great concerns about this technology. She feels it's so unpredictable and uncontrollable that it probably can never be properly regulated. And in fact, in looking across North America and looking at the oil and gas commissions as I was writing this book, I couldn't find one jurisdiction that had set up a proper groundwater monitoring program that could track contamination of groundwater over time at multiple levels. No one has done it. No one has done it because it would cost so much that it would make fracking uneconomic. So, Jessica Ernst has a point.
What are her relations like? Now, you mentioned she found her dream home in Rosebud, Alberta, about an hour outside of Calgary. How long had she been there before the gas exploration started around her?
Well, she'd moved there in 1998, and then Encana came and began a campaign to drill into shallow coal beds in the region in around 2003 and 2004. And they came in rather secretly. They didn't really tell ranchers and farmers in the area exactly what they were doing, nor were they very upfront about the fact that it was a science experiment. They really had no idea how to get the methane out of these coal seams, how to make the coal let go of that methane, and what chemicals might be needed or what amount of force might be required, and as well as the compression. And she was quite horrified how her chief client had treated her own community. And that's when she resigned from that contract. And then she found herself in one battle after another with regulators and her own government And she found that incredibly dispiriting and demoralizing. Here was somebody who had worked in industry all of her life, made good money, thought that the industry was being properly regulated by government, only to discover that that's not what the government or industry or regulators were interested in. They were there to facilitate development. They were not to regulate bad actors or bad practices.
We have a call here from Mark in Redding, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Nikiforuk. His book is Slick Water.
Good morning. The natural gas that's in her well and everywhere else around there is not been odorized, right? It's natural gas, therefore odorless. Is that correct?
Yes, it is odorless. But not in all of the cases. In some cases, there has been H2S contamination of the wells. But in her particular case, it's odorless.
Okay, another question. Is she able to grow a garden in her on her land?
But yeah, she does. But she doesn't use her well water for that. She uses river water.
Mm-hmm. Well, where are you going with the questions, Mark?
Just questions. You know, I have nothing going for fracking. My father was a geologist. He thought all that kind of stuff was just fabulous. I hate it myself. I think it's just evil. But, you know, those are my questions. That's it.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate that. So just the general idea about fracking again. I mean, and how much exploration? You talk about the fact that nobody's spending a lot of time or money monitoring water, any apparently. But what about the geologic effects? I mean, I was reading in The New Yorker not long ago about Oklahoma and the general level of denial about the disposal wells and the effect on earthquakes there. That Oklahoma has gone way up the scale in earthquakes in recent years since the fracking boom resumed. And yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of information really about anything geological in there.
Well, I mean, Oklahoma is now the most seismically active state in the Union, which is incredible. And it's all due to fluid injection. And so there's this kind of this weird debate going on where the industry is saying, well, this is just wastewater that we're injecting into the ground. It has nothing to do with hydraulic fracturing, and which is not true because all fluid injection is a kind of hydraulic fracturing. So you take any fluid and inject it into the ground at high speeds, either for long periods of time or for short periods of time, you will probably hit and trigger faults and cause some kind of seismic activity. And in Oklahoma's case, it's been formidable. There have been major lawsuits there. There have been earthquake activity of 5.6. Not only that, you have around these injection well sites have changed the geology and the pressure underground so dramatically that when you have major earthquakes now in places like Chile, and where you'd have an earthquake of magnitude of 8, killing 600 people and bringing down buildings and all that sort of stuff, that earthquake will register at these injection well sites in Oklahoma and cause aftershocks in Oklahoma itself.
Let me see if I get that
right.
Giving
you an indication of how destabilized the geology has become because of all this additional pressure being added to these faults.
Did you just say earthquakes in Chile can trigger earthquakes in Oklahoma?
Yes, I just did.
Wow.
Yeah, wow indeed. And that's research that's come out of California itself. And not only that, they also found that earthquakes, let's say in Malaysia and Japan, had also triggered aftershocks at injection well sites in Texas and Colorado as well.
So not only the seismic activity, but when you crack the ground far under you and then take stuff out of it, I mean, there's got to be incidents of land subsidence or shifting rocks or sinking in places. I mean, sinkholes forming from any of this?
Yeah. When you deplete a reservoir, a common problem associated with that can be subsidence. So the ground will actually, you know, it's kind of like, if you can imagine oil and gas deposit as a balloon in the ground filled with water, and then you empty it, and then everything else around it will come crashing down, and the rocks around it will all actually fracture and collapse. And then you can have massive subsidence, and that too can cause extraordinary earthquakes, and that's become a huge problem, let's say, in a place like Holland at the moment, where a consortium of companies have been removing gas from the Groningen field in northern Holland for more than 30 years and have caused just an extraordinary number of earthquakes in the region, changing insurance policies, concerns about public safety, everything in that region as a consequence. So the industry has a lot of long-term effects that we haven't always taken fully into account, because we're always rushing madly to make a dollar. And the liabilities associated with fracking are just quite extraordinary, because it's a non-linear form of chaos. Industry cannot always control the direction of its fracks. They will always follow the path of least resistance. And industry really at this point has no good tool to know where existing faults are. They have no computer model that will tell them where all their fractures will go. Nor do they have always a very good idea of where existing natural fractures or man-made pathways are already in the ground. You've got a very complicated picture underground that you are just rattling with all of this brute force. I mean, and the big issue again that regulators have really failed to properly monitor is that of gas migration. So you're rattling the ground with all the seismic activity, and that's what hydraulic fracturing is, or fluid injection is. Then you're going to loosen a lot of the gases in the ground, and they will come to surface. The same way that gases will come to surface just prior to an earthquake as the vibrations begin to ramp up in the ground. And what they found in places like Australia, where they're fracking coal fields, is that the levels of radon, methane, and CO2 in the atmosphere above these fields is three times higher than that in a normal agricultural community. But the really big story about gas migration is, you know, it is all taking place in the United States and in the San Juan Basin in New Mexico and Colorado, where they fracked coal seams in the Fruitland coal formation in the 1980s, increased the permeability of that formation 100-fold, with the result that they had gas migrating out of outcrops, gas migrating out of river bottoms, gas migrating into people's homes and pump houses. And to this day, the largest methane anomaly in the United States is now hovering over the San Juan Basin. And it's about the size of Connecticut, and it accounts for something like, you know, some extraordinary figure, like 10% of the methane emissions in the United States. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2.
Right, been said many times. Let's take a call here from Bill in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Nikiforuk, the author of Slick Water.
Good morning. I'd just like to clarify that an injection well is a well that is used in an existing oil or gas field, and it's not fracturing the formation. All it's doing is increasing the production of the existing formation to acquire more oil and gas.
But how increase the production?
How?
Yeah.
Because under pressure the water that's been and what they do is it pushes more oil to the new wells that have been drilled in this field. So they take the old wells that would have been producing oil and make them injection wells. And then that pushes oil through the formation. And it, instead of recovering just, say, 30% of the oil from that formation, they can recover more than 30%, you know, depending on the formation, the porosity, and the permeability. And a disposal well is what they've been using in the fracking industry to dispose of the what they call wastewater, waste fluids. It's not just water, it's fluids. And there's no pressure there. That is, those disposal wells actually just dispose of it, and it's never used again, never seen again.
All right, Bill, let's get a response because we're almost out of time here, but I appreciate the call. Thoughts on this, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I mean, I probably didn't use those terms correctly, injection well or disposal well. But so the disposal well is putting water in the ground over long periods of time. that water can connect to faults and also cause earthquake activity. The injection wells, where you are also putting water into an old oil and gas formation to enhance recovery, that too can also stimulate fracturing. Again, just by pushing stuff around, you can connect to other rocks and force them open. So I still stand by what I was saying in terms of any fluid injection into the ground can act as a form of hydraulic fracturing. And industry discovered this very fact just by pouring cement into well bores to try to seal them and to protect groundwater. And they found that they couldn't account for where a lot of the cement went. And it wasn't until they actually mapped some of these well bores out that they found that the cement was actually going into the ground, creating fractures and traveling very long distances that they hadn't anticipated.
It's a fascinating and very thorough look at what goes on with fracking. The book is called Slick Water. Andrew Nikiforuk, the Canadian journalist, wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, take it easy.